It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with your friends if you like it. Today, we have a conversation with Senator from Utah, Mike Lee, who has a new book, Saving Nine, which focuses on the Supreme Court, the institution, the efforts to undermine it, and essentially a number of critical debates that have to be addressed in the coming years regarding the entity of the court and our role as it relates to it when it comes to federalism and the United States. Mike Lee touches on a number of different topics, including, of course, the leak of the Dobbs versus Jackson decision, which has roiled the court in so many critical ways. He also weighs in on a number of different aspects of politics related to the incoming class of Republicans that is expected to emerge after November. Mike Lee, coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Senator Mike Lee, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Oh, thank you.
I have to say, I don't like the fact that your book is timed so well. It's kind of a disappointing measure of our democratic republic that it is timed so well.
Yeah, but you and me both, Ben. It worries me greatly.
But it does seem like you are speaking to a very real threat to the existence, really, of one of our three branches of government.
Oh, that's exactly right. As I explained in Saving Nine, I talk about this in Chapter 1 right out of the gates. The Supreme Court is not what many Americans think that it is. It's certainly not what the far left wants it to be. That is, it's not a policy-making organ of the federal government. Its sole job is a narrow one, is to resolve cases and controversies, resolve disputes about the meaning of federal law as those cases are brought within the court's jurisdiction. That's it. Now, the left wants it to be a policy-making body. They therefore want to politicize it more and to formalize the politicization of the court by giving President Biden the power to nominate up to 4 additional Supreme Court justices. This is not for the purpose of making sure that no one justice has to work too hard. It's not a staffing problem, a human resources problem. This is simply a bald-faced political move, an attempt to commandeer the one independent branch of the federal government and bring it to heel to the whims of the far left movement.
As you outline in Saving Nine, this is not the first time that this has been dabbled with. Tell us a little bit about the historical experience when it came to the way that the court was threatened over the years with expansion or with changes that would have fundamentally altered the outcomes potentially of cases.
As I discuss in Chapter 4 of Saving Nine, President Franklin D. Roosevelt was the last president who seriously championed one of these efforts. And it was at the very beginning of his second term, during FDR's first term in office, the Supreme Court had pushed back on him because he was trying to expand the size, reach, scope, and cost of the federal government, ostensibly in order to enhance his ability to combat the effects of the Great Depression. The court kept pushing back on him, and a consistent theme within the pushback from the court was that, you know, the Commerce Clause of Article 1, Section 8, the part of the Constitution that gives the federal government the power to regulate trade or commerce between the states, isn't unlimited, and it's basically supposed to be limited to interstate and foreign commercial transactions and to channels or instrumentalities of interstate commerce. FDR didn't like this because it meant that most of his legislative agenda was going to be outside the power of the federal government as a whole. So he started threatening the Supreme Court rather overtly, denigrating it, delegitimizing it, and ultimately trying to arrogate to himself the power to appoint a number of additional justices so that he could affect the outcome of these rulings. In the end, that legislation failed, but it failed only after it had its intended effect. Associate Justice Owen Roberts switched his vote, switched his interpretation of the Commerce Clause, and by so doing, in a case called NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin Steel, decided April 12, 1937, the Supreme Court abandoned its historical interpretation and the original understanding of the Commerce Clause and effectively amended the Constitution, adopting one of the most significant modifications to that document ever by saying Congress could regulate anything that substantially affects interstate commerce. And that, as I explained in Saving Nine, changed everything. It's why we have a $31 trillion debt. It's why Americans spend months out of every year just trying to pay their federal taxes. It's why we've got a federal regulatory system that imposes $2 trillion in compliance costs every year. All of these things came about as a result of the last time somebody attempted court packing in this country. We can't let that happen again.
We obviously witnessed an extreme breach of not just practice, but of any kind of ethical loyalty when we saw this advance leak of an opinion in Dobbs v. Jackson that has roiled the entire conversation over the past several weeks and is obviously driving anticipation of what the outcome will be in that case. What was your reaction when you first saw that leak happen? How can we prevent that from happening in the future? And is this a situation where we are witnessing perhaps the last branch of government that the American people had faith in terms of performing its duties in a way that would be resistant to the forces of media and of kind of the partisanship that happens within other institutions? Is that all breaking down in front of us?
Yeah. So as to the first question, my very first thought was, surely this has to be a joke. This can't be real, because never in the court's entire history, as far as I'm aware, has a leak of this magnitude occurred. The mainstream news media seem fond of saying, oh, other leaks have happened. Well, okay, yeah, word has leaked out about how someone thinks the court is likely to rule. But very often, those are just educated guesses that may turn out to be right or turn out to be wrong. This was an entire opinion. And so as soon as I saw the draft opinion and that it appeared, if this were a joke, it was a very elaborate one, I concluded that it was likely legitimate. My next concern was for the safety of the members of the court themselves, including and especially my former boss, Justice Alito, the author of that masterfully written draft majority opinion. By the way, Ben, anyone, regardless of where they stand on the abortion issue, regardless of how they think they feel about Roe, really should read Justice Alito's draft opinion in the Dobbs case. It's incredibly well done because it makes the case that he's right.
Demanding people see the movie before they render a judgment on it, Senator Lee, is not something that is in keeping with our Twitter society, but yes.
Exactly. They really ought to bother to read it before they praise it, before they condemn it and praise their own response to it. Mm-hmm. As to what it says about the court and how we stop this from happening in the future, it is deeply distressing that this happened. As a former Supreme Court law clerk myself, I can tell you this is wildly inappropriate. Not just inappropriate, but it's wrong on many levels. I really believe they will catch the person who did it. And I believe that if it is a law clerk, as I suspect it might be, this person should never be allowed to practice law. Is there are so many protections that are put in place to prevent this from happening. That was not his or her information to leak. It's that of the court. The court finishes its business in private because it needs to have the ability to deliberate and make sure that the opinion's ready to release. This was a gross breach of trust. Look, whenever we handled opinions, we did so with great care. We weren't allowed, we had to use a separate computer system to edit draft opinions, one that had no outside internet connection. Whenever we had a hard copy, when we were finished with it, we couldn't just put it in the trash, we had to put it in a burn bag. At the end of the day, the burn bags were collected, they were shredded, both vertically and horizontally, turning them into a confetti. That confetti was then put into an incinerator and turned into a black ash. Water was added, turning into a dark slurry before it ever left the custody of the court. That's how seriously the court takes this. And that's why it was such a betrayal of the court's practices and its confidentiality.
You know, I think, though, that the damage is done in a certain way. You know, you have this this view now of, you know, once this seal has been broken, it will be broken again.
Yeah.
Is there a way to put the horse back in the barn on this? Or are we now destined to, you know, a situation where, I mean, you know, forget matters of enormous moral import and ethic and, you know, things that have divided the country for half a century. Just a case that's in front of the court that could matter to corporate entities where they, you know, could potentially find a way to, you know, to pay or compensate someone within the hierarchy here in order to gain access beforehand, in order to know, you know, how to respond to it. That's something that has enormous potential to roil not just the function of the court, but the way that people view the legal system of the United States.
Yes, that's exactly right, Ben. That's a grave concern, especially when you consider what the intended effect of this is. The intended effect of this kind of strategy, which could carry through to the types of disputes you're describing involving commercial disputes among and between large for-profit corporations. But make no mistake, the intended outcome of this was and remains to threaten, intimidate, delegitimize, harass, and isolate those members of the court joining, authoring, or considering joining the opinion in question. That is exactly the opposite of the purpose that the Constitution has in mind for the Supreme Court of the United States, and yet another reason why we've got to prohibit Congress from trying to politicize it further by packing the Supreme Court.
You have the perspective on the judiciary of being, of having multiple roles in terms of arguing in front of it, in terms of being a clerk, in terms of your background. The judiciary has to this point essentially escaped the partisan nature of so much of our politics today that stretches through the bureaucracy, the administrators, every other aspect of our life. Is that possible to maintain? Or are we moving toward a direction, one that, you know, I think that a lot of people anticipated in the last 20 years or so, where people are just viewed as having red ties or blue ties when they get on. They just have an R or a D after their name, the same as members of the Senate or the Congress. And that's just the way that things are going to be.
Yeah. Look, I find that once people are educated and informed about the true facts about the Supreme Court, that helps to dispel the mythology that has led to its politicization. Let me explain what I mean. In chapter one of Saving Nine, I described the fact that in most cases, I mean the overwhelming majority of cases that the Supreme Court decides on the merits are decided either 9-0, 8-1, or 7-2, not reflecting the inclination of the president who appointed them or the Senate that confirmed them. And so in the overwhelming majority of all cases decided by the Supreme Court, there's not a clear favored political outcome. It's remarkable that that happens, especially in a court where they've got control over their own docket. They decide what cases to hear, and they tend overwhelmingly to limit their review of cases to cases in which multiple courts have reached differing conclusions as to the same discrete provision of federal law or the Constitution that's at issue. So the fact that they reach unanimous or nearly unanimous decisions as often as they do ought itself to be something that, once presented to the American people, will help them understand the need to depoliticize the court and make sure that we don't lose that. It's going to get a lot worse if we propel this narrative by suggesting the false choice that we either have to pack the court or allow Republicans to delegitimize it because Republicans have recently had some nominations to the Supreme Court that have gone through. That's absolute nonsense, and it's belied by the facts. I provide those facts in Saving Nine.
The Dobbs v. Jackson case, if it proceeds the way that the leaked opinion indicates it does, is going to return the issue of abortion to the states. Utah, many other states that are across the country, Oklahoma and Mississippi and others, will have one view on the abortion issue. States like California and New York will have opposite views, and including perhaps even more extreme views than the initial Roe decision. In terms of a moment that requires a reintroduction of federalism and an ability of us to live alongside fellow Americans who have very opposite views on a matter of deep moral importance, do you believe that the Dobbs v. Jackson decision is going to be something that ultimately is a benefit to the American people in terms of illustrating the way that our system ought to work, as opposed to being the kind of calamitous decay that some media commentators seem to think?
Ben, I think it has precisely that ability. It has all the makings of being that case, the ultimate teachable moment, as Barack Obama might have said. And the reason is this showcases and highlights our two structural protections in the Constitution, the vertical protection of federalism and the horizontal protection of separation of powers. And it highlights it in a particularly nice way, given the way that the left has blatantly mischaracterized the case itself. Look at the way the left is trying to describe the Dobbs ruling and its ramifications. They're saying that this is going to destroy our democracy. Nothing could be further from the truth. And in fact, if you want to see something that is fundamentally anti-democratic, you need look no further than Roe versus Wade itself. In Roe versus Wade, you had essentially a judicial oligarchy. What were then 7 of 9 lawyers wearing black robes sitting on the Supreme Court of the United States in 1973, arbitrarily, capriciously, and without any foothold in the Constitution, its text, structure, history, anything, just grafting onto the Constitution a right that didn't exist, a right that in effect said no state or other government may restrict abortion in any meaningful way. That was about as undemocratic as it gets. And so now, with Roe versus Wade being on the verge of being overturned, if that actually happens, this will return this debatable matter to its proper sphere where it can be publicly debated. Most of the time, given that this is not a federal issue, most of the time that will mean state legislation, not federal legislation. That's a great example in the differences between the three branches. It's a great example of how we actually can have greater democratic input, not in spite of, but because of the fact that we're following the Constitution.
You were part of a Tea Party wave. That seems a long time ago, doesn't it? Of people who arrived in Washington dedicated to upending a lot of ways that it had typically been run. Not just a partisan wave, one that was had different designs. There's going to be a wave, in all likelihood, a few months from now, in November, that brings a lot of new voices and new faces to the House and to the Senate. People who are similarly going to have a mind on upending the way things are going because Americans believe they're going so bad. When it comes to their approach, what lessons, what things would you take away from your own experience in advising them how to approach the task of governing, the task of serving as a representative or a senator, that would result in significant change, change that would last, not just, you know, sequestration or something like that in terms of holding it up as being, you know, indicative of what you were trying to achieve, but something more significant, what would you tell them to do and how would it be different?
The best form of lasting change that we could bring about is I hope and frankly expect that we are looking at another moment that, like 2010, will provide a resounding response from the American people to government overreach. I think it can stick this time if we keep our efforts focused on two main features. Number one, the need for more of government to be local, to be exercised at the state local level rather than the national level. We call that federalism. And number two, to restore the horizontal structural protections in the Constitution, known collectively as separation of powers. The very first thing that I think we ought to do, the first and most important thing that we could accomplish would be to pass legislation like the REINS Act. That's an acronym, R-E-I-N-S, stands for Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny. But its message is simple. Let's restore the power to make federal law to the people's elected lawmakers and not allow it to be exercised continually by unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats. If we just made that one change, that would start to rebalance the separation of powers. And it would also help us with rebalancing the power distribution between the national government and our state governments. I explained this at great length in Saving Nine. In that respect, the book is about much more than just the Supreme Court or court packing. It's about what's happened to our Constitution to get us to this point in the first place. And it will help you win every political argument moving forward because it'll help you analyze what's fundamentally broken with our government.
I fear that when all these folks show up, they're going to be loaded for bear, eager to work, you know, happy to, you know, do all sorts of different activities in order to push back against terrible policies from a very unpopular administration, but that they won't really know how to do it. And that their focus or their lack of focus will ultimately lead to the same kind of problems that we've seen in previous wave elections, that they basically are consumed by the same swamp that they wanted to drain. Is there a way to avoid that? Is there a way to guide new members in a direction that will be beneficial and that will, you know, ultimately lead to picking the right fight where you are going to go to the mattresses, where you're going to, you know, burn everything down around you in order to make a certain point to the American people, as opposed to just having a bunch of folks who are shooting off in all manner of directions on social media and the like?
Yeah. Look, regardless of what they say or do on social media or elsewhere, we will lose. We will do nothing lasting to make a difference unless our efforts focus first and foremost on restoring the primacy of the Constitution in our political dialogue. And by that, I principally mean federalism and separation of powers. That's why it's so important that when people get here, if elected with an anti-Washington mandate, none of that's going to stick unless you focus on those features of our government that are designed not to change, but features that have been eroded over the last 85 years. That's why I focus so aggressively and intensively on federalism and separation of powers. And that's why the REINS Act and other reforms like it are so crucial to the success of the conservative movement and to the movement of all people who just want to live their lives and don't want to see their lives micromanaged by somebody in Washington, D.C.
We're talking on a day when two pieces of information have come out related to free speech that I wanted to bring up. One is the resignation of Ilya Shapiro from the Georgetown role, where he was going to be the head of their Constitution Project. He's written about that at length. I know that you respect Ilya and have a high opinion of him, as I do. And the news that FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, is expanding and renaming itself. They're still going to be the FIRE acronym, to basically fill a role that the ACLU had perhaps traditionally held when it came to defending free speech rights across the American experience, not just on campus. Free speech in America seems to be really under attack, not just from powers of government and bureaucracy, but from all manner of different foes, including corporate America. How can Republicans, the pro-business party, the pro-capitalism party, push back against these anti-free speech tendencies in ways that are responsible and do not in fighting back against either wokeism or the values of a more leftist corporate America in the HR space in particular, give up a defense of capitalism and a belief that markets are good?
Well, the first thing we could do is stop funding institutions that behave this way, recognizing that it's anti-academic. In fact, it's un-American for them to do that. So we can stop funding them. Secondly, we can, and I believe must, make sure that the government doesn't ever get into the position of enforcing ESG standards or ESG reporting. Mm-hmm. This is the ultimate dream of the left, is to enlist the power of the federal government to legitimize and, in fact, mandate ESG reporting so that there is no resistance possible by anyone who disagrees with the efforts of the ESG movement. I'd like to say there, by the way, I think this is that's a sad development for Georgetown University. Ilya Shapiro is a remarkable person and has a remarkable mind, and a mind that I think the students at Georgetown University really could and did benefit from by having him there. And I think it's unfortunate that they lack the commitment to true academic diversity. Georgetown University is all about touting, like every other university in America, claiming to be open of different viewpoints and celebrating diversity. But one thing they are completely unwilling to accept is diversity of thought, diversity of viewpoint. This type of lack of academic freedom is the sort of thing that destroys the healthy learning environment that we've come to expect from our universities. And I think that's sad for Georgetown, it's sad for Ilya, and it's sad for higher education in America.
Senator Lee, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. I will let you go with this question. You really have made an argument here in Saving Nine that is from it feels like it comes from the heart. I've read your other books. I've not to in any way denigrate them, but this one feels near and dear to you. Do you really feel deep down that the court will be able to survive this current period of unrest and the assault that seems to be undertaken against its very existence?
Whether the Supreme Court survives is entirely up to us. That's why I wrote Saving Nine. I started foreseeing this problem near the beginning of 2021, and I've been worried about it ever since then. So I started writing furiously to try to get ahead of this. Saving Nine will give you the tools that you need in order to spark the discussion to make sure that court packing never gains a foothold again. Because as I explain in the book, the last time this was attempted, while it failed legislatively, it succeeded because it threatened and intimidated the court into changing the way it interpreted the Constitution. We're still paying for that today. We can't allow that to happen. We can't afford that kind of delegitimization of the court and the document that the court often interprets to occur again. Saving the Nine will give the American people the tools that they need to combat that. So if you haven't bought a copy yet, go out and buy one after you've read it. Loan your copy out. Let as many people read it as possible. We need the American people educated on what's truly at stake.
Senator Mike Lee, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ben.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast coming to you right after this. So I wanted to share with you a few notes from my take on a number of different topics that have emerged over the past week or so. And one in particular that is front of mind for me is these developments related to free speech in America. There is this Ilya Shapiro resignation. Ilya is a friend of mine and had been in line to run a center on constitutional governance for Georgetown University. I brought this up, obviously, in my interview with Senator Lee, and he decided to step down as opposed to continue to run it, even after being vindicated on a technicality, it turned out, for tweets that he had sent out regarding the nomination of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Now, I want to make something clear here. Affirmative action is racist. It is clearly racist. It is an adjudication of people based on their race as opposed to their qualifications. That's something that I think is indisputable. It's just a factual thing. You can, you know, argue about whether that's something that is justified based on American history, based on, you know, past racial discrimination and the like. But it is itself an adjudication of someone's value based on race, as opposed to based on their resume. And, you know, Ilya had the approach on Twitter of evaluating this in public, something that is never advisable if you want to ascend within the swamp that is Washington, D.C. He pointed out that Joe Biden was essentially making a decision based on race, as opposed to based on the qualifications of the people in front of him. And he was pointing this out in the context of the fact that there are numerous people who could qualify for the Supreme Court from the left of center perspective, some, you know, people who would be categorized as liberals and the like, who would not fit this qualification, either because they were not Black women, which is the exclusive area that Joe Biden had said he would pick from, or because they would not fit some kind of other ideological test. But mostly what he was saying was that, you know, there are all these different candidates out there who could presumably qualify for this position who are being left out of the decision process, either because they're white men, they're Asians, they are not, you know, fitting this narrow category, or a racial category and a gender category that Joe Biden had said he would select from. This is the sort of thing that, you know, not only should you not be suspended for, it's obvious. It's just a factual statement. And Ilya ended up running into the teeth of the Georgetown governance because of it. Look, he ended up deciding to step down after he had won his narrow technical victory in terms of maintaining a position, because he understood that he would not be long for the world of academia, given the kind of metrics that were going to be placed upon him and the restrictions that would result almost assuredly in terms of him being reported again in the future for expressing his opinion. In addition to this, there's the news that the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, has dramatically increased their level of activity, not just on campus, but outside of campus, essentially stepping into the void that had been left by the ACLU. I think this is an enormous benefit to the American population, and something that's going to be, you know, very much an active participant in terms of the level of activity that we see from FIRE going forward on behalf of a lot of different Americans who are confronting challenges when it comes to free speech. Look, the situation with Ilya Shapiro is very depressing on one level, but at the other level, it is honest. It is an indication of where Georgetown University stands when it comes to free speech and their perspective as it relates to the featuring of, you know, ideological opponents of the leftist agenda on their campus. So, you know, is it a good thing? Of course not. Is it honest? Yes. And therefore, I think we have to be prepared to respond to it as people who believe in free speech and still hold the values of the Bill of Rights in ways that are increasingly confrontational and do not allow various entities, whether they be academic, political, or corporate, to get away with such actions. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We will be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.